Welcome to the Think Pieces podcast, produced by the Institute of Advanced Studies at University College London. This podcast picks up themes from the Institute's online review, Think Pieces, engaging in conversations with authors, scholars, and policymakers from inside and outside UCL.
Hello, and welcome to the second podcast episode on Indigenous Ecologies and Environmental Crisis, hosted by me, Olivia Origo-Styles,
and me, Adriana Suarez. In 2023, we were postdoctoral fellows at the UCL Institute of Advanced Studies. During our time at the Institute, we edited a journal issue for the Institute's online review, Think Pieces, as part of which we are recording two podcast episodes. For our first episode, we talked to Emile Kimi about his latest book, Le Maya Kwatsesh, Our Maya Word, bringing to the fore Maya authors and the poetics of resistance.
In this episode, we're in conversation with Nanika Mathur, Professor of Anthropology and South Asian Studies at Wolfson College, Oxford University. Her research covers the anthropology of politics, development, environment, law, and human-animal studies.
Nanika is the author of Paper Tiger, Law, Bureaucracy, and the Developmental State in Himalayan India, which addresses everyday bureaucratic life on the Himalayan borderland. We've met her on Zoom to discuss her second book, Crooked Cats, Beastly Encounters in the Anthropocene, which was published in 2021. Can you please start perhaps by telling us a little bit about the book and how it came about?
Yeah, in terms of how this book came about, it's actually quite an old story in the sense that the book actually began very much with my PhD work in 2006. At the time, I was doing fieldwork out of government offices in northern India, in this Himalayan state called Uttarakhand. You know, I had literally just begun my fieldwork when one day, this town that I was working in, Gopeshwar, this quote-unquote man-eating leopard turned up in the town and started haunting it before she was eventually killed 3 months later. And she was hunted down. And, you know, by that time, she had killed like 6 or 7 humans, had injured a lot of other people, had spread this, you know, what was described as this reign of terror in the town by that stage. So I got interested, obviously, in this phenomenon of big cats that make prey of humans, right from 2006, because of this, you know, very, very terrifying encounter. But I actually started writing this book a bit later. So this particular leopard, she had this sort of walk-on part in my first book in Paper Tiger. But then I was studying leopards through questions of bureaucracy and law. So, you know, in what ways do bureaucratic temporalities, in what ways do conservationist law shape the way in which the state responds or doesn't respond to ferocious beasts like big cats that make prey of humans. And so in Paper Tiger, I write about this, but only in the final chapter. And as I said, very much through the prism of law and bureaucracy. Anyway, at that time, I thought, you know, the book came out in late 2015, early 2016, and I thought I was sort of done with big cats. And I went back to the state, to this part of India, to begin fieldwork on another new project. This was my postdoctoral project. And I sort of landed in the capital city of Uttarakhand, which is called Dehradun, in 2015 to start research on something which was linked to the state again, to digital processes, to questions of migration, to questions of transparency and accountability of the Indian state. But very soon after I started this fieldwork, like within weeks of me arriving in Dehradun, a very similar sort of incident happened to what had happened almost a decade back in Gopeshwar, which is that this crooked cat turned up in the town. She hunted this young woman down and killed her. And this was happening just down the road from where I was living. And this is actually, it was sort of an uncanny mirroring of what had happened almost a decade back in Gopeshwar. And so what the result was that I kind of abandoned the plan that I had for this postdoctoral project and actually just started researching big cats in earnest. I had been keeping an interest in this, you know, human non-human relations in Uttarakhand for ever since I started in 2006. But 2015 onwards, I just sort of threw myself back into this BC world. And the result is this book that came out a couple of years back now.
Great, thank you. That's a really interesting story. And as you were leaving it behind, then it kind of reemerged. Something that caught my attention in the prologue, actually, you were referring to COVID at the beginning and the questions that many of us had regarding the origins of the virus, how it spread, and the effectiveness of vaccinations. Looking back now, have your fears and thoughts about the COVID-19 virus change over this period or the period of writing the book between that period and today?
Yeah, thank you for that. You know, so when I was putting the finishing touches to this book, end of March, early April 2020, and I was writing the prologue at the time, which is what you're referring to here, it was kind of, again, uncanny. That's a word I keep using, but it was eerie and uncanny how the lockdown at that point reminded me of my first encounter with a crooked cat back in Gopeshwar in 2006, where once again, it felt like we were in a kind of a lockdown. We weren't using that term. And of course, the reasons were very different. But there was this sense of this predator lurking outside, and there was nothing that one could do about it. Like, there was this profound uncertainty. We don't know, like with COVID-19, especially at that stage, we didn't fully understand what is happening. We didn't know how it spread. We didn't know what the effects were. We didn't know how it would end, if it would end, you know, when vaccines would come out. Like, I think it was this time where we were all living in this moment where everything was uncertain, and it was profoundly so, right? It was also a time when I think this conceit of human mastery of the world, or this sense that we have as living in the present moment, that we understand how the world functions and what the non-human, what is the power or the violence of the non-human world has been sort of tamed in some ways by human actions. That was sort of laid to shreds, especially in the early phase of the pandemic. And again, that sort of reminded me of, you know, how this book began way back in 2006. So that's why I wrote about it in the prologue, because to me, there were some parallels there. Looking back at it now, one of the reasons I wrote about the pandemic in the prologue was not just because it was familiar and it was eerie and it kind of felt like I couldn't not write about it, given the earth-shattering moment that was. But I think the thing that I sort of had hoped for somewhere, and which I also sort of mentioned in the book a few times, is that, you know, we need to, one of the arguments of this book is that this moment demands that we rethink human non-human relations on the planet, how we inhabit this world, how we live with the non-human world, whether it's a virus or it's a big cat or it's rivers or, you know, trees or whatever. We need to reframe our relationship with the non-human and hope that somehow that this idea that we have, that firstly, we know everything about the non-human, but also that we can control nature, that we can control what is happening around us, that conceit has to be laid bare, right? It has to be sort of shredded apart, so to say. And looking back, I kind of feel the sense of disappointment. I feel like, you know, it is, we're all pretending as if the pandemic is over. It's not. It's continuing to, you know, make a lot of people ill. It's continuing to kill a lot of people. It has this, we have not even begun to process the trauma and the horror of what has happened over the past 3 years. But we're all sort of pretending, like states are pretending, individuals are pretending, communities and organizations are kind of pretending like it's all okay. And we just sort of pick up this thing and start walking again as if nothing happened. I find that very disturbing, because I feel like one of the things I'd hoped for in that moment was that, you know, this is a kind of a reckoning with the ecological crisis, with the political economic crises that we submerged in, with sort of, this is kind of a slap in the face of the systems that we built up around us, whether these are political or social or ecological. And it kind of feels like that reckoning, that moment of reckoning did not happen, that we had these like 2 or 3 years of absolute horror and fear and trepidation. But we're just sort of moving on, marching on, as if our worlds have not shifted the way that perhaps they should.
Like a missed opportunity in a way.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, what is it that will force us to confront, you know, whatever we want to call it, the climate crisis or the political crisis or like late capital? Like, what is it that will force us to confront it?
What you're also kind of pointing at is this with the idea of uncertainty, right? That we were perhaps we're so unable yet in the Western world and to kind of grasp uncertainty. And of course the main theme of the book is about, well, in a way, how do we govern, how do we manage for climatic uncertainty when we don't really know the direct causes of the phenomena that we are faced with. And in that sense, I wanted to ask, what do you think that we might learn from the lived experiences of people who are at the receiving end of a crooked cat behavior, for example, in the face of the uncertainty that we are in?
Yeah, thank you for picking up the theme of uncertainty, because that is something that underlies this whole book, and it underlies it in two ways. One is this question of how one lives with uncertainty, which is what you are also sort of asking here, and how can we think about what that everyday life is where you're living in an environment where nothing is certain anymore, right? You're not certain whether the rains will come on time. You're not certain whether your harvest will be what it should be. You're not certain about whether you'll get a job. You're not certain about, you know, whether that big cat that lives in the jungle next to your house is crooked or not. Is it straightforward, normal, or is it something that could be predatory, right? Which is what I'm looking at, the sense of that this could or perhaps is not a predatory beast in lurking in your vicinity. So how do you then deal with these big questions of what does it mean to live in this climate, to live in this landscape where nothing is certain anymore, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, these are landscapes where there were always other worlds or social worlds that weren't guided with the sense of certainty that we perhaps assume in certain, you know, more privileged parts of the world, like the ones that we inhabit. But there is something about this accentuating sense of increased uncertainty, which is also, for me, a defining condition of life at the Anthropocene, is where the things that we have held as stable is something that we understood and knew, this not just the future, but also the present moment, that's all sort of slipping away. It's becoming more and more difficult to believe in these practices of certainty. So how do we think about what it means to live in this uncertainty? That is, I think, one aspect of it. I think the other aspect of it is really this question of how does one, and here I'm talking about myself as an anthropologist, as an academic outside, how does one write about it? And for me, that was sort of a big methodological issue with this. And of course, it's not different from this other question of how do people who live with uncertainty talk and speak and articulate that experience. But for me, it was also the sense of like, how do we as academics in this moment tell stories or write narratives that can capture this uncertainty without either romanticizing it or being flippant about it? You know, how do you get the right sort of tenor around this living with uncertainty? And I think this whole book is an exercise in that.
Absolutely. And I think you really accomplished that very well when you mentioned that you can have straightforward or simple big cat, and you can also have a twisted or crooked big cat or a man-eater. And in a way, it's like all these boundaries, right, are not clear-cut. Maybe yeah. You can have a cat that is all of those. And that's the difficulty. How do we deal with that complexity? And I think you really get to that in the book.
That is something that was learned over time from my interlocutors in terms of like, how do we know whether this big cat is seedha or simple, or is it a crooked one, right? Like how do we get to understand that boundary? You know, it's not something that we have foolproof knowledge of, but there are certain ways in which you can try to gauge crookedness or not. And there are certain ways in which you can protect yourself and your family and your loved ones from crooked behavior or from predatory behavior when you live in this particular landscape. And what are those ways? What are those modes? How do you articulate it? How do you live with that? How do you structure your life in a way so that you are potentially protected from predatory behavior? There's no like formula, there's no policy, there's no program that can do it. These are sort of learned ways of inhabiting a particular landscape.
Can I just add there that I think it's beautiful how you put it, because it's about the behavior. And we could extend this to humans, right? You could have some crooked humans or some innocent humans, but it's not the human, but it's probably the behavior that we might display in certain situations or not, and how I think it's beautiful how you open up that in the book and, you know, open the question as well as to what kind of skills do we need to develop for what is happening now? What sort of behaviors do we need to encourage or learn?
Yeah, and I think this kind of takes us on to the kind of the mega category of the Anthropocene that you anchor the book's analysis in. I guess the question there is, does the positioning of non-human animals, in this case crooked cats, as you've talked about, as central actors, provide us with significantly different ways of understanding the Anthropocene?
I would argue that crooked cats are a distinctive way of trying to understand what the Anthropocene is. Perhaps I can just give a bit of sort of background to why I've argued this, right? And perhaps I can do this ethnographically. I've been like sort of interested in these big cats now since 2006, as I said. And over time, I have been seeing how, okay, so one is how people talk about this, different kinds of people talk about these big cats. The other is how the Indian state tries to sort of govern them and respond to them and tame them and regulate them. And then we have the conservationist organizations that are trying to protect big cats, et cetera. And then we have the wider framing of empire, where big cats have acquired a very particular personality and have a particular history and politics to them, which are linked to imperial practices around hunting and governance as well. And then, of course, we have the commodification of big cats as these exotic, charismatic megafauna that, you know, we see in big brands, we see this in conservationist regimes, we see this in all sorts of ways through which the imagery of big cats sort of, you know, proliferate. So you see, like, big cats occupy very different kinds of spaces and are talked about very differently, including in academic work. Over time, as I've been tracking them, it has been very clear to me that the behavior of big cats is changing. That according to my interlocutors, big cats are becoming more and more predatory. There is quite a bit of statistical or state data that also supports this, but it's not perhaps as comprehensive as some people might want to see. But I take very seriously the claims of my interlocutors in the mountains that big cats are acting in ways that are increasingly out of character, that are increasingly bizarre. And so then when I would ask them, I was like, so why do you think that's happening? Like, why do you think this big cat, this particular big cat attacked you? Or why do you think that there is, we're seeing these crooked animals in this way in the Himalaya? I'm sort of fascinated by the kind of responses I typically got. There was not blame on the individual cat per se. I mean, obviously there was anger at that individual animal and they wanted that animal hunted down or removed or, you know, something like that. There is obviously that. But with time and in longer sort of expositions on it, the ways in which people talked about crooked cats was through recourse to political power, through recourse to particular kinds of human-made structures, through the naming of big capitalists or industrialists who are destroying the Himalaya, who are, you know, denuding the forests, who are damming the rivers, who are spreading toxic waste everywhere, who are literally breaking down mountains and killing the habitat of these animals over there. And there was a sort of, so I was fascinated with the kind of connections that people were making with the literary manner in which a lot of these connections were made, the ways in which people were talking about this contemporary moment. And I found these stories to be powerful examples of what we call the Anthropocene. And for me, a central argument of this book is that if you pay careful attention to these beastly tales, to the ways in which people tell stories about crooked cats in this moment, if we are careful to trace the connections that they're making, if we lend ourselves to the sort of the logics and the poetics of these stories, the ways in which they talk about regimes of governance and the kind of intimacies that emerge from it, I think we can then productively deploy the concept of the Anthropocene.
It's really interesting because I think the sort of central point there is that when people are talking about crooked cats, they're also talking about a lot of other big things like capitalism or the state. But I guess that sort of takes us onto a kind of a sort of methodological or even perhaps an epistemological question, really, because it's, if we're saying that by talking about crooked cats, they're also talking about something else, how do we know that in that sense? Like, how do we know that the interlocutors are not just talking about crooked cats?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that's a very good question. And it's one that is, I think, often posed of ethnographic work, right? That what is the sort of labor of translation that I am putting in here, right? What are the assumptions that I, as the author, am making here? Where in my interviews with people or in just like hanging out, I hear them, you know, talking about, like joking about it or making particular kinds of connections. Or even if they're not making the connections, like just talking about it or telling me stories about it. You're right, they could just be talking about, you know, crooked cats per se. But I think this is where the role of the anthropologist and how I'm making particular kinds of connections are important to foreground, right? And I think what you're sort of drawing attention to here and you're probing is the kind of connections I have made. When I am picking up particular narratives and stories and I am placing them within this frame of the Anthropocene, I did really wrestle with this a lot, right? So this book has changed form over the years. In the beginning, it was quite a straightforward account of human non-human relations, of, you know, multi-species entanglements. It was, in the beginning, I was not so enamored of the concept of the Anthropocene. In fact, I wrote an early article in 2015 where I heavily criticized the concept of the Anthropocene. But I think over time, when I worked through my material, when I went back and reheard my interviews, the more time I spent in it, the more I studied it, the more I looked at other kinds of sources, including from wildlife biology and from conservation manuals and from history, the more I became convinced that the framing for this project cannot be one that is just about the Indian Himalaya or just about South Asia or even just about things like, you know, how do humans and non-humans relate to one another or how do we think about changing relations. For me, the framing became one that is a planetary framing. It became a framing also in which the climate crisis was absolutely central, but it also became one where the story is not just about big cats in India or big cats in the Himalaya. It is actually a more planetary story, so to say, right? And now the question is that I have imposed this framework of the Anthropocene on it. I think too many times I say that this is, you can think of it as perhaps a productive concept, a productive frame, and perhaps you will not think of it as a productive frame, you being the reader, right? That perhaps I will be able to convince you that this framing is useful, and perhaps I won't be able to convince you that this framing is useful. I'm not wedded to the concept of Anthropocene, but I do think that it is one that helped me make sense of this material, that helped me actually understand both the methodological and academic stakes of this project, but also the political stakes of this project in this moment in time.
I wanted to highlight something that you mentioned as well in the book, and that is quite important, and I like how you bring out this mismatch between bureaucracy and policies that seem to be drafted from above and kind of detached from daily lived experiences of the people who are actually at the receiving end of this problem. So I wanted to see whether you wanted to tell us a little bit more about this, because in my view, it looks as if it's a conflict between different scales as well, like the transnational conservationist scale, you know, that wants to protect tigers, but then the local scales who are quite affected by what's going on. So whether you could talk a little bit about this mismatch between bureaucracy and lived experience, and how can we, what recommendations perhaps could we draw from the book to help us in this governing of uncertainty?
My obsession sort of with the bureaucracy comes partly from my previous book, which is an account of your bureaucracy, and where I was sort of positioned within bureaucratic spaces. Those were my primary field sites. And this was my first look at big cats, was from within the space of the government office, where you would see conservationist law being translated into practice, where you would see documents and you would see the state at work around this question of how you govern big cats. But the reason that in this book I stress the role of the state are the couple of reasons. One is, I think, as you said, the scales of it, like the kind of scales it transmits, that it is clear to me that the way in which big cats are governed in India today, or big cats are governed in the Himalaya today, is not just about, firstly, the national scale, because, you know, there is a particular policy coming from New Delhi that is executed there. No, because these policies are very much in, especially around conservation of charismatic megafauna in this period of extinction, are deeply in conversation with global moves around conservation, right? Global policies. They're deeply influenced by the work that international NGOs on animal rights and conservation do, whether it's the World Wildlife Fund or the IUCN. But they're also, like, for me, fascinatingly, given the post-colony that is India, they're also deeply affected by colonial regimes, colonial understandings of how you hunt, how you govern, how you control nature, that they're sort of seeping into these policies. And you can see these also in the ways in which local bureaucrats act, that, you know, there is this culture of sarkar, the culture of the state, that actually has a long history in India going back to colonial and even pre-colonial periods. And so you can't sort of understand all of this outside these scales, right? And so these scales are also temporal. So there is the colonial period, which is impinging on the moment, but there's also this question of the projection of the future, this future where, you know, India will not have as many tigers as it should, or this future where there is looming extinction or this endangerment of particular species that we are sort of living in. And I'm sort of interested in seeing how they intersect around the figure of governing these big cats. So I think for me, it was very important to center the government of big cats, as I call it, in it. I also think, to go back to our previous discussion on the Anthropocene, one of the ways in which the Anthropocene is still needs a bit of work is to also think about how the state and how regimes of governance are so central to any understandings of the Anthropocene. And I think that the literature on that is a bit thin at the moment, right? That we don't have enough of an understanding of how the climate crisis is linked to national and international and local state practices and processes, and how do we make those links? And I think, again, like this another way in which this becomes important is the point that you raised earlier also, which is this question of living with uncertainty. Right, and how state forms or political authorities try to paper over that uncertainty by acting as if they're in control, by acting as if they know why big cats are acting the way they are, by acting as if they can control it, like as if this is manageable, right? So there's this whole sort of fiction of the recent government of big cats that is produced, whereas the reality of it is quite different. And that's that. It's that world, that in-between space of actually living with big cats and actually seeing what's happening behind the scenes and the way people talk about it, that I think is my ethnographic project in a way, to look at this intersection between the state and these, like, different levels, scales of the state and the lived reality of it. Now, in terms of, like, policy prescriptions or what does one do, I think for me, the most important thing is to first acknowledge the uncertainty, is to first acknowledge that this rational mode of governance of the non-human world is actually a myth. It's a bit of a fiction, right? And actually what's happening is something different. Now, what is it that we need to do to change? Again, instead of, like, I wouldn't be able to say, give like a policy prescription, but the thing that I would say, and something that I feel very, very strongly about, is that we really need to change our understanding of non-humans and of non-human animals. We need to make space within bureaucratic and policy regimes for a deeper engagement and a deeper sort of understanding of human non-human entanglements and how they shape worlds, which are beyond this understanding of mastery and control and regulation that are sort of almost baked into these governance structures. And for me, this involves a shift in how we look at the world. It involves a shift in how we understand this contemporary moment. It involves, and this is, again, to come back to the Anthropocene framing, this is why one of the reasons I think the Anthropocene framing is productive, because Anthropocene names this moment and calls out the kind of damage humans have done to the planet. And this damage is predicated on a lot of things, one of which is this complete sort of obliviousness to the power, the affective power, to the intimate relations that we have with the non-human, and, you know, an understanding of, say, animal agency and animal emotions and animal intelligence, and putting that at the center of our worlds instead of some sort of quaint story about, you know, these crooked cats, or about, you know, something that's separate from it. We can't see these worlds as separate. We have to sort of see them in their really messy entanglements together.
I wanted to pick up again on kind of the question of the state, but from a different angle. And I think your work has really fascinating similarities with Alpa Shah's work on Adivasi communities in Jharkhand. And she writes about how they're in conflict, how villagers are in conflict with the elephants that the state wants to protect and conserve. She says that elephants are inconveniently nature out of place, which in many ways we could talk about with the crooked cats as well. But the point is that the exploitative state here is the villain in both of these stories. But I wondered, from the perspective of kind of within the rural world or within sort of the villages, what kind of political world are they operating, in the sense that what kind of movements are they participating in that sort of govern their relationship with the state? So rather than the state per se, what about those from below?
In terms of how villagers interact with the state and how has this changed over time? So like, how do we think about it from, say, another side, right? Which is the ways in which people who are living under sort of the reign of terror, these big cats, how do they sort of respond to it? I think the thing that I would foreground most strongly here is the critique of wildlife conservation, and not of wildlife conservation per se as a conservationist impulse per se, but of the forms of conservationism which are elite, which are anti-humanist, which are actually very much predicated on saving the lives of these charismatic megafauna rather than thinking about the humans who sort of live in the vicinity. That I think this is what we really see over there, a very sharp critique of the state, but the critique of the state is also critique of conservationism and the kind of forms it has taken. And you can see this critique coming out in petitions. You can see it in the ways in which you have public protests against, you know, when people will literally march up to the district magistrate's office or like take out these processions, railing against the Indian state because of the fact that they value the life of a big cat more than they value human lives. You can see the way in which this is resisted, the kind of protest mechanisms that are used, whether these are sit-ins or what are called dharnas, or it is this intense petitioning against specific big cats, which I also write about, this whole process of how you petition, how you actually lobby the state to protect humans and not protect big cats, because, you know, the way it works seems to be that the state is only interested in protecting big cats and they don't really care about human lives. I think this for me is like, it is the sharpest critique of conservationism that I have read, which is coming, I mean, I don't mean my rendition, but I mean the ways in which people in the Himalaya critique the state and the ways in which they talk about particular laws and policies around it. How has this changed over time? You know, I think in terms of how it's changed over time is also, to me, very telling. It has changed over time because there is more anger. This is becoming more and more commonplace, this whole thing of, you know, big cats acting in increasingly crooked ways. And so you can see that there is more anger, but not just at the state, there is also an anger against the destruction of nature, against the destruction of landscapes and environments. You know, where the target, of course, the state remains central, because there's also a particular, very specific history of animosity with the Indian state that you see in the Himalaya, which has a long colonial history as well, but it's very much there, the post-colonial period as well. It's also linked to a movement for statehood that the state had seen. So there's a very specific relationship with the Indian state, which is one of animosity that has existed for a very long time here, which is sort of exacerbated in these moments. But I think what I'm finding more and more interesting, and this is something that I hope to study more in the future, is how this anger is finding new forms. It's finding a new discourse which is linked to the discourse of the climate crisis, of the ecological collapse, of things being out of kilter, of everything being uncertain, and this loss of control over the certainty that we thought our lives were structured by.
That touches upon all the themes, actually, that we were raising, like uncertainty in the role of the state, but also this elitist view of how the world should be, or conservation. What do you think is then, if, you know, these entanglements, multi-species entanglement and living with the non-human or more than human, and being more conscious about that, acknowledging that, as you said, in that scenario that we're in now, and probably more and more will be in the coming years to come, I wonder, what is actually the future of conservation then?
Yeah, this is a great question. I think conservation becomes more and more important given the mass extinction that we're seeing, given the endangerment that we're living in. But I think a conservation that is much more people-centered, that takes on board that's not the sort of fortress conservation. That's not this this project of conservation where humans are separate from these non-humans that they're protecting, right? But one that takes account of the fact that human non-humans live in close proximity to one another, especially in places like South Asia, where it is really impossible to say that, you know, this is tiger land and that's not tiger land, like, or this is leopard territory and this is not leopard, this is human territory. Like, these kind of separations, these dualities through which a lot of conservation operates is flawed. And I think more and more critical work on conservationism is showing that. I think we need more conservation, but we need one that is actually much more alive to this mixedness, to the ways in which there are very different demands in different parts of the world. I'm in the United States this year, and, you know, it's been fascinating to look at, like, how national parks over here are sort of carved out and how they're completely separate from humans. Something that is not really possible in India, right? Where this kind of separation is something that is really difficult to affect and to keep going in many ways. Yeah, and I also feel like this is also part of that sort of green imperialism that we have read so much about and seen, where there are particular models that have been developed in North America or in Western Europe, well, largely North America in this case, and then they're imported to the global South as if this is the only way in which you can do conservation. And it's been flagrantly shown to be false. That's something that we need to sort of keep in mind.
Picking up on that, the question of colonialism and sort of the imperial sort of a mindset in that, with regards specifically to India, obviously, I think you mentioned this in the book, but and others have worked on this, but tiger and big cat hunting loomed very large in British imperial masculinized imaginaries in India. And you refer also to the fact that a lot of the hunters of the crooked cats come from long lines of aristocratic hunting families. So how far do you think these legacies of colonialism shape the attitudes to big cats specifically, but also conservation? But as opposed to other beastly creatures, though, I suppose I'm thinking there.
Yeah, I think, you know, there is something quite specific about the ways in which big cats are governed, understood, regulated, hunted, considered beautiful, considered regal and imperial, or considered, you know, symbols of the nation. So the tiger is India's national symbol. Different states have, like, Gujarat, the state of Gujarat has the lion as its symbol. I mean, so there is a way in which the iconography of big cats is also very much linked to a very specific understanding of India. And I think that all of these colonial forms actually have a deep, deep impact on the present. I talk about it in almost every chapter in some form or the other. So, of course, there is the whole thing of hunting, the way you hunt them, why you should hunt them and not, you know, use some other means to sort of try to protect humans instead of just immediately going and hunting them down, and how that's linked to a particular hunting tradition, which goes back to Mughal times, but was really perfected under the British colonial period, where the job of a man of state actually also became one of protecting his subjects through the hunting of, you know, man-eaters. And hence you have such a large amount of, like, literature on it. You have books, you have the Shikar diaries, these hunting diaries, you have these visuals, right? Like, absolutely iconic visuals of colonialism in India is, you know, the viceroy standing on top of a dead tiger with his foot on it, and, you know, with this whole masculine gaze, and so it's so much part of that world visually. But I think for me, one of the most important ways in which I could see this imperial legacy, and I think, again, this is where ethnography becomes so important, or participant observation becomes important, was in the everyday life of the state, in the culture of the state, in the way in which there were very similar idioms that were invoked, right? The ways in which there's one very charismatic hunter who I write a lot about in this book called Jim Corbett, who's also written these best-selling books on man-eaters in India. And Jim Corbett is from the exact region that I work on in India. And his legacy is unbelievable. Like, forest officials or conservationists model themselves on him. Hunters refer to themselves as mini Corbetts. The way his, you know, people would literally be narrating aspects from his hunting diaries or from his books to me to explain why what is happening today is happening. They're like, you know, as Corbett has written in this book, which would be like a century old by now, he wrote this about the story about this particular tiger, and this is why this is happening today. And of course, Corbett himself was an arch-imperialist and was very much a part of the imperial apparatus. But you see that it's so alive today. So in the conservationist literature that we're just discussing, we've had a lot of criticism of green imperialism or of these neocolonial modes of conserving nature. But I don't think we have fully perhaps grasped how these imperial modes of governing nature continue to endure in everyday banal forms in the post-colony even today, and how important they are in this BC world, so to say. And I think that one of my contributions to this perhaps is bringing out this legacy of colonialism, not just, you know, as sort of a theoretical or conceptual work, but actually in the mundane everydayness of it. Like, how do you know that tiger is the one we should hunt? Well, you know, in these shikar diaries, in these hunting diaries, we can see that this is how this happened. Let's do that. You know, the kind of hats they wear, the kind of clothes they wear, the kind of comportment, the way they write about hunting, or not just even hunting, about governing, about conserving, is drawn from these colonial accounts. And so I think it's very, very important to center them in trying to understand the contemporary moment.
Yeah, I guess you're pointing also at how those legacies are in our minds as well, in the discourses that we embody and incorporate in our minds and bodies, and then continue replicating and reproducing. We really, really appreciate talking to you today, Nainika, and we're really grateful. And we are going to invite our listeners to read Crooked Cat's Beastly Encounters in the Anthropocene, because it's a really interesting book and you're touching upon so many different themes and interlacing them. So thank you very much for writing it and for being with us today.
Thank you so much, both of you, for your close reading, your critical engagement, and for giving me this platform to talk a bit more about it. I really enjoyed this conversation and I'm very grateful to the two of you.
Thank you to Nainika for her insights and wonderful conversation. We hope that you enjoyed it as much as we did.
This episode was the second of two that we created and hosted for Think Pieces. You can listen to the podcast on the Think Pieces website and subscribe to it on Spotify, Apple Music and SoundCloud. This episode was produced by Marta Lisson. I'm Olivia.
And I'm Adriana. Thank you very much for listening.